It's to the best of our knowledge from PRX. I'm Ann Strainchamps. For thousands of years, women ruled the world. But today we barely know their names. Why?
To find the ancient Egyptian queens of old, you have to always have an eye to reconstructing what was removed. But sometimes you're able to see that she's escaped destruction.
This is Kara Cooney. She's an Egyptologist, and today she's our guide to places where you can still see traces of those ancient queens.
The best example is Hatshepsut's wonderful chapel called the Red Chapel, and it's in the temple at Karnak in the open-air museum. So it's outside. There's palm trees above you. The birds are chirping. You get to go inside of this newly reconstructed chapel made of red quartzite stone. There you see her in all of her glory, walking with her nephew, doing temple rituals. You can almost smell the incense. You can feel like you're in one of the offering halls with the chanting and the sistra.
But for centuries, even the memory of Hatshepsut was erased by the men who followed her.
There's another part of Karnak where the Egyptians believe the god himself would have dwelled. In these rooms, Hatshepsut's figure has been chiseled so completely that you just see these chisel marks in a vague human form. The legs are still vaguely there. The arms are still vaguely there. She's just a ghost of herself. And it's almost like she's behind this chiseling trying to get out. And I, as the historian, am there trying to resuscitate her from the past.
And of course, it's not just in the past. We all know stories about the price women pay for power, even today. And now women historians and classic scholars are uprooting some of our longstanding cultural anxieties about women in power by digging up the past. In some cases, literally. The Egyptologist Kara Cooney has written about a woman who should have been legendary, the great queen Hatshepsut. But there were actually many women who ruled ancient Egypt, which makes it a good place to begin.
I start my class with a slide of Angela, Hillary, Condi, and Maggie. Then I'll put up a picture of Cleopatra and talk about how her rule was willfully misinterpreted. Or I talk about how Hatshepsut's very successful rule was completely forgotten. And so what happens with women from the ancient world, and this is a pretty basic pattern, if they're successful, the credit for that success is taken by another man after them. So we've forgotten them entirely and nobody even knows how to pronounce the name of Hatshepsut, for example. Or we demonize them and turn them into a Cleopatra, women who are thought of as these sexually free, man-eating, scary, angry, selfish, and duplicitous creatures that need to be controlled.
Wow. So it's the same story still going on today.
Oh, my God, yes. And I just listened to NPR this morning. They were talking about the year of the woman, the year of the woman. And it was 1992. And then we had another year of the woman in 2002. And now we're having another year of the woman in 2018 in political elections. I don't see this changing anytime soon, this hostility towards females in power.
Okay, well, I want to go back to the millennium of the woman, because you've got a new book coming out in November called When Women Rule the World. This was ancient Egypt. And first of all, I think it would come as a huge surprise to a lot of people that there was ever any time when women ruled the world.
It's true. And it's only in Egypt where you have this divine kingship par excellence. The king is a god. And if that king dies and there's no man to rule after him, the Egyptians would very often say, okay, we're going to go with the chick. We're going to go with a girl. She's got the blood of this divine king in her veins. And they bow down before her as their new god incarnate.
Well, how many women were there who ruled as pharaohs?
As Pharaoh's five that we know of, if Nitocris is more than just a fairy tale, then six. And then there were many, many other women who ruled on behalf of their sons, their brothers, as the one pulling the strings, but didn't necessarily get the credit for it.
Well, so the greatest of these was Hatshepsut. She ruled for 22 years. This was the golden age of Egypt. How did she come to power?
She came to power as the high priestess called the god's wife of Amun, and she was appointed as such by her father during his reign. And when Thutmose I died, Hatshepsut became queen to her half-brother, Thutmose II. And yes, this was a common strategy, this incestuous relationship. And Thutmose II was sickly. If you look at his mummy, he had smallpox marks all over his face and an enlarged heart. And he died after only 3 years of rule, we think. And Hatshepsut steps in as regent on behalf of her young nephew and makes herself king.
And she even dressed like a king at a certain point, right? Didn't she wear a fake beard?
Yeah, there's this one statue that shows her with big biceps and pectoral muscles, and she's just as buff as could be. And yes, she has a false beard, but whether she wanted to do this, I don't think it's her interest in cross-dressing. It's her understanding that she can't change the patriarchy. She has to fit to the patriarchy itself.
That makes me think about the 1980s when we women were wearing power suits.
Yes, this is still a problem. And I talk to my students about this. What do you decide to wear to the interview? What is too masculinizing? Mm-hmm. What is too feminizing? And how do you find the middle road?
So how would you assess Hatshepsut's success?
Hatshepsut was the best female king that Egypt had ever seen. She ruled Egypt traditionally. She left it better than she found it. She ruled during a time period of great prosperity. There was wealth all around her. She was so successful that it was easy for the men after her to take credit for all that she had done.
Is there some evidence that she was deliberately erased from the historical record?
She was indeed deliberately erased from the historical record, and it was by her own nephew, Thutmose III. He buried her in state as a king in the Valley of the Kings from all of the archaeological evidence that we have, and he waited a good 20-some years until he chose one of his sons to come after him. It was then that he sent out the orders to have her name erased wherever he could find it in Egypt's temples and to have her statue smashed up into tiny bits.
Well, so we get Hatshepsut, this great ruler who's been forgotten, whereas Cleopatra, another great ruler, but still she lost her empire, is an icon. You have made the case that this is not accidental, that in some ways we're biased against seeing women as successful leaders. Can you explain?
Most of the time when a woman is able to transcend to leader of state, something's gone horribly wrong. There's a civil war and all the men are dead, or an empire is poised to take over a certain political system and no one else is able to step in. So when there is crisis, there is often a woman ruler. And people then look back at history, or maybe even in the same time, and say, because there is a woman ruler, we thus have crisis.
You could also say the same of male rulers. A successful reign is boring, right? So historically, we remember the people who started wars are flamed out.
Yes, but the men aren't remembered as failures because of their gender. They're just thought of as failures because you invaded Russia in the middle of winter, and who the hell does that? I'm going to Napoleon, obviously. We'll blame failure on hubris, on psychology, on upbringing, on a mean mother, We don't blame it on his manhood, but a woman fails and immediately the first knee-jerk reaction is, oh, it's because she rules differently, because she rules like a woman, and she's too soft, she's too emotional, she can't tell people what to do, she's only looking after her own. There's all kinds of stories that we feed into her femininity. We would not do that with a man.
So we've been talking about these ancient queens and the ways in which their leadership was mistrusted. And of course, women's leadership is still mistrusted today.
Yeah.
Are there any particular lessons you take from the ancient Egyptian queens that would apply to women today?
I'm not sure if the ancient Egyptians are the ones who are going to give us the answer. Maybe one by one they can. But In the same way that if we are all racists, if we take a white baby and show the baby faces of black or white people, the baby wants to look at the white faces, then we might also all be misogynists.
Hmm.
And the only way to change that is to start the conversation and continually re-educate ourselves as human beings. The more we talk about our knee-jerk hostility towards females in power, the more we can transcend it. I think that constant conversation is the only way forward.
Kara Cooney is an Egyptologist at UCLA. Her biography of Hatshepsut is called The Woman Who Would Be King. And keep an eye out for her next book, a portrait of six queens of ancient Egypt. It's called When Women Ruled the World. And now another ancient woman rescued from myth, Circe, the Greek goddess who turned Odysseus' men into pigs. After thousands of years, she finally gets to tell the story.
After I changed a crew, I would watch them scrabbling and crying in the sty, falling over each other, stupid with their horror. They hated it all, their newly voluptuous flesh, their delicate split trotters, their swollen bellies dragging in the earth's muck. It was a humiliation, a debasement. They were sick with longing for their hands, those appendages men use to mitigate the world. Come, I would say to them, it's not that bad. You should appreciate a pig's advantages. Mud slick and swift, they are hard to catch. Low to the ground, they cannot easily be knocked over. They are not like dogs, they do not need your love. They can thrive anywhere, on anything, scraps and trash. They look witless and dull, which lulls their enemies, but they are clever. They will remember your face. They never listened. The truth is, men make terrible pigs.
Okay, that is definitely a woman's version of the myth. And we have Madeline Miller to thank for it. Her previous novel, The Song of Achilles, was based on Homer's Iliad, and she is back with a new novel called Circe, about the famous goddess who turned men into pigs, which somehow seems so remarkably appropriate today.
Actually, I think what drew me first of all is that mystery. Why is she turning men to pigs? Homer doesn't tell us. And so the assumption comes to be, well, it's just because she's evil or she's a irrational woman or she hates men.
But could you read it as essentially a kind of Me Too moment?
Well, absolutely. And you know, I think one of the things that I love about these myths is how much they show us human nature. And women are still dealing with a lot of these same issues.
Well, especially right now, I was thinking you must have been writing this book or at least polishing it or something in the wake of all the revelations about Harvey Weinstein, Matt Lauer, just so many prominent stories about men behaving like pigs. Was it strange to be working with an ancient story and then finding echoes of it in the news?
It was honestly really eerie. I was in my final round of edits and I would be working and then I would go check the news and it would be literally about what I had just been writing about. And then I would check the news again and it would be another story that was a scene that I had been writing about. And I have always felt very passionately that these myths are relevant, but it really drove the point home.
So in the Odyssey, that pig story is pretty much all we hear about Circe, but you have made her the center of her own story.
Mm-hmm.
So what captivated you enough about her that you wanted to give her her whole book?
Well, there are very few female characters like Circe in ancient myth. She is at once very powerful. She lives alone on this deserted island surrounded by tame lions and wolves doing whatever she wants to do. And there was the fact that she was the first witch in Western literature.
What does that even mean, the first witch in Western literature?
So, you know, the Odyssey is from around 750 or 700 BCE, and here she is with her witchy attributes. She has her wand, she has her potions and herbs and spells. As I studied witches and witchcraft and what it meant to be a witch, what it seemed to me is that a witch is a woman who has more power than people think she should have.
Mm-hmm.
And that's definitely the case with Cersei. And what's amazing to me is how often that word gets thrown around, even today, with powerful women.
Yeah, I was thinking about the entire last presidential campaign and how often Hillary Clinton got called a witch.
Absolutely. And what's interesting is how often witch and whore have kind of walked hand in hand. A whore is what we call a woman who transgresses norms of female sexuality. And then a witch is almost always about power.
So in writing about Cersei, the first witch in Western literature, do you also see her as a feminist icon?
I do, because her encounter with Odysseus is such an iconic battle of the sexes. Here she is, she's turning men to pigs, and then Odysseus comes and he pulls out his sword. Could we get more phallic? And then she has to sort of kneel and be subdued. That's the heroic male arc. He confronts this woman of power, she has to be put back in her place, and then she becomes benevolent and helps him and carries him on his way. But Cersei, like many other women, is not really ever given a chance to have her own voice. Cersei appears in 2+ books of the Odyssey. So very deliberately, I held Odysseus to 2+ chapters of this novel because I thought turnabout is fair play. And I wanted her to really have her chance to tell her whole story. And she does. She has this amazing backstory that has nothing to do with Odysseus. She is the daughter of the sun god Helios. She's Prometheus's cousin, and she's related to a whole host of other notable divinities at the same time. When I was born, the name for what I was did not exist. They called me Nymph, assuming I would be like my mother and aunts and 1,000 cousins. Least of the lesser goddesses, our powers were so modest they could scarcely ensure our eternities. We spoke to fish and nurtured flowers, coaxed drops from the clouds or salt from the waves. That word, nymph, paced out the length and breadth of our futures. In our language, it means not just goddess, but bride.
She doesn't even know what she is when she's born. There aren't even words to describe her or her inner life or experience, which has been the story of women emerging into history and into narrative for centuries, right?
Yes. I think women have very much had to carve out a place for themselves because no one is handing them that place. So they are blazing the trail, they are hacking through the woods, and they are saying, you know, this is the place I'm going to make for myself. Odysseus spends the whole Odyssey longing for home, for the Greek word is nostos, for homecoming. And I wanted that to animate Circe's journey, except she's not like Odysseus. She doesn't have an Ithaca. She has to not only get to her home, but she has to discover what that home might be and make it herself.
But are you saying something also about the necessity of solitude for a woman to discover her true self?
Absolutely. Virginia Woolf said it beautifully in A Room of One's Own, and I think Cersei is right behind that, but she gets a whole island.
Wish I had an island of my own.
Me too.
The other thing that I love is that she doesn't just come to witchcraft as a fully blown witch. She has to discover it.
Let me say what sorcery is not. It is not divine power which comes with a thought and a blink. It must be made and worked, planned and searched out, dug up, dried, chopped and ground, cooked, spoken over and sung. Even after all that, it can fail as gods do not. If my herbs are not fresh enough, if my attention falters, if my will is weak, the drafts go stale and rancid in my hands. By rights, I should never have come to witchcraft. Gods hate all toil. It is their nature. No fingers are ever chafed, no muscles strained. Witchcraft is nothing but such drudgery. So why did I not mind? For 100 generations, I had walked the world, drowsy and dull, idle and at my ease. I left no prince, I did no deeds. Then I learned that I could bend the world to my will, as a bow is bent for an arrow. I would have done that toil 1,000 times to keep such power in my hands. I thought. This is how Zeus felt when he first lifted the thunderbolt.
For me, those are some of the most beautiful sections of writing, the part where she's teaching herself magic. How did you conceptualize it?
Well, there are two pieces of that that really interested me. Circe is a goddess, and she's born into this family of incredibly powerful gods. Helios is her father. And the gods never have to work for anything. They snap their fingers and they get what they want. And they never have to try and fail. And so she really has something that the other gods don't have. She has that persistence, that ability to really forge ahead very stubbornly. The other piece of that that I was really excited about was how many mistakes she makes and how that is okay. I think women are often held to the standard of having to be perfect, not being allowed to make mistakes. The ancient Greek heroes made horrendous mistakes all the time. Odysseus and Achilles are full of flaws as much as they are full of virtues and strengths. So I wanted Circe to make mistakes and to be flawed and to not have the answers. Women should be allowed to be just as messy and complicated as the male heroes have been by right for centuries.
I keep thinking about Laurel Thatcher Ulrich's famous line about how well-behaved women rarely make history.
Exactly.
It's like, damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Yes. Well, and as people drew on the story of Odysseus over the centuries, in the Middle Ages, Circe was an incredibly popular figure as sort of an example of this is what happens when you let wives have too much power. You don't want this to happen to you. They take away your manhood. They literally make you a beast. And she was used as an object lesson. And so that's so interesting to me, too, is how much this anxiety about female power has reproduced itself through the figure of Circe, but also through all these other female characters.
Madeline Miller. Her new novel is called Circe. And meanwhile, across the Atlantic, classicist Natalie Haynes is retelling some of the most famous Greek tragedies from the woman's perspective. Halima Shah gets the story and a guide to those tricky Greek pronunciations.
I have to really remember that you say Oedipus, where I would say Oedipus, because this is one of those transatlantic things.
I know.
And I would say Medea. Do you say Medea?
Probably, but we're both probably saying it wrong, right? Because we're
definitely
originally
are.
In Greek.
Yeah, Oedipus is what it would be in Greek. So, yeah.
Why don't we just say that?
We're all differently wrong.
Yeah.
More on reading the classics in the age of Me Too next. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. One of the most famous Greek tragedies is the one about Oedipus, the mythic king of Thebes. As the story goes, an oracle warns that Oedipus will one day murder his father and marry his own mother. Now, he doesn't actually know who his biological parents are, and he tries hard to avoid his fate, only to discover years later, to his horror, that his wife Jocasta is actually also his mother. Which means that his two daughters, Antigone and Ismene, are also his sisters. Jocasta kills herself, Oedipus blinds himself, he leaves forever. It's all pretty much a downer. And it's a story classicist Natalie Haynes has now retold through the eyes of the female characters. Her novel, The Children of Jocasta, is out in the UK and forthcoming in the US. And Halima Shah wondered, why retell what is already one of the most famous plays ever written?
I wanted to tell this story from the women's perspectives for a bunch of reasons, but mainly when you read Oedipus, the Sophocles version, you get such a lot of him and you get 120 lines of Jocasta. So she's not even a tenth of the play. And it's like, you know, we have this constant parade of information that he is clever. And yet when it comes to the great revelation of the play, she works it out before he does.
Mm-hmm.
So we're told all the way through how smart he is. And it's like, yeah, but who's the smartest person in the room? Ahem. No, guess again. Ahem. Yeah, it's her. It's absolutely her. And I thought, here's this extraordinary woman sitting in the middle of this play, kind of hidden from us because she's got 120 lines.
The original tragedy is really focused on Oedipus's emotional turmoil, and it, understandably so. He's going through some stuff.
It's a difficult day for him.
Yeah,
I mean, there's just no way around that. He is having a hard, hard day.
So when you started thinking about writing about the women's side, I mean, like you said, this is shifting the spotlight from Oedipus to Jocasta. It's by no means a departure from the original character of Jocasta because she was always clever. But when you start to focus on the women's side, do you feel like you unearthed new feelings or new emotions in the story itself?
Oh, definitely, because she has 120 lines in Oedipus Tyrannus. Ismene has 60 lines in Antigone. She is virtually not there. And I might add, nearly all those lines are basically the lines given to all women in Hollywood films, namely, oh, but be careful to somebody doing more interesting things. So I'll read you a little bit from the very start of The Children of Jocasta, the moment where Jocasta finds out that she is going to be married to a considerably older man, the King of Thebes. "I have done the best deal of my life," he told her, "and you are to marry the king." "What do you mean?" she said. "King Laius needs a wife," her mother explained. "You're very lucky." "Why would I want to marry him instead of someone who isn't older than my father?" "Sometimes," her mother sighed, "I think you take pleasure in being willfully obtuse. I really do. So let me explain to you in words that even your little brother would understand. Thebes needs a powerful king. Laius is getting older and people are growing nervous. What if something happens to him when he's away from the city? What then? The elders will fight to succeed him. The city could fall into chaos." She reached over to Jocasta and grabbed her shoulder next to the fabric knots which formed the top of her daughter's tunic. "That can't happen," she said. "The king needs a son, and before that, he needs a wife, a young one, who could act as regent until the child comes of age if something happened to him." She shook Jocasta's shoulder with each alternate word. "And that is going to be you, because your father is clever and lucky, which is exactly why I married him. Do you understand?" What a bitch. I can't bear her, mother. Oh, she's horrible. I'm so glad when she dies, I can't tell you.
But, you know, the other thing is that I think women especially can have a kind of tenuous relationship with stories that are canonized, especially classics or even fairy tales. You see people reexamining Persephone's story and being called a rape instead of an abduction. Even Belle from Beauty and the Beast, some people are looking at her and saying, well, she probably had a case of Stockholm syndrome because she was...
Not in the Disney version. Not in the Disney version. She's very happy and she likes Lumiere and Cogsworth. Stop it. Stop being mean. I love Beauty and the Beast.
I mean, as a classicist, do you ever... I don't know. Did you have your own inner turmoil when you were ever reading these books?
Yes, of course. Some of the stuff that I have read in my life is profoundly misogynistic and extremely hateful and very difficult to read. Absolutely. Juvenal Satire 6, the one against women, is absolutely bristling misogyny. It's not just that it sets your teeth on edge, it sort of makes you feel like you need a bath and you're like, oh. But he wrote jokes brilliantly. His way with words, particularly word order, which is really important in Latin poetry, is absolutely extraordinary.
But there always seems to be a tension with continuing to teach literature that is, one, so old and also very Western. Is there some merit in maybe shifting our attention away from literature that may not be in line with the values of who we are today, especially when there is a wealth of literature that in some ways is?
I think it would be a shame to think that only things which are contemporary can speak to a contemporary society. I just don't think that that's true. I think it's always the case that there's something that we can take from these classics. There was a production of Antigone put on in refugee camps across the Syrian border by women who had been removed from Syria during the civil war. The woman who played Antigone, who remember as a teenage girl, was in her mid-20s and she had three children. So you would say, okay, she has nothing in common with Antigone. Antigone is a teenage girl. She dies, spoiler, you know, a bride to death, she says she'll be. She doesn't ever marry. She doesn't ever lose her virginity. She doesn't ever have children. And, you know, how could this woman who had this experience possibly, you know what? She had had to leave a brother unburied in the streets of Syria. How dare we suggest that these texts are for educated people in a privileged existence? This text spoke so profoundly to her because it was her life. Every time we put these plays or these stories or anything from the ancient world in front of people and they get something from it, then I'm marking that down as a win. I'll be doing it until I die.
Natalie Haynes has written a whole bunch of books about the classics, including The Ancient Guide to Modern Life. Halima Shah talked with her about her new novel, The Children of Jocasta, which is out in the UK and due out soon in the US. Next, people fall in love with the classics in unexpected ways.
I was in a elementary school play production of The Odyssey when I was 8 years old.
After 10 long years.
It's one of my most vivid childhood memories. I remember both the thrill of getting to create a tinfoil helmet and being dressed up as a goddess. I remember the blinding of the papier-mâché masked headmaster using like a broomstick handle.
Arise, Odysseus!
I remember that my sister was cast as Helen of Troy and I had an anxious time of thinking, is that going to be a much bigger part than mine? Ooh. I was a shy kid who just moved to a new school. I'm not sure how much I would have been able to articulate this at the time, but I had an emotional connection with the fact that it's a story about being lost.
Somewhere in a faraway land, my Odysseus, my awesome man.
These are very strange places, and none of them is really home, which was exactly how I felt at the time.
Well, today, Emily Wilson is a classicist, and she has just become the first woman ever to translate Homer's Odyssey into English. Now, translating from the ancient Greek has been an old boys' club for centuries, so this is a pretty big first. And Emily not only brought a feminist perspective to the job, she also set out to do a new kind of translation, one that sounds a lot more like the original Greek of Homer. When Steve Paulson asked her to read a bit from the beginning, they discovered that she had unfortunately forgotten to bring it with her to the studio. Luckily, that didn't stop her.
Andra moi enepe musa polutropon hos malapolla plankthe epeitroien hierontoliathron epersen.
Wow, that's beautiful. I mean, I have no idea. I mean, I'm looking at your translation here, but
I just tried to roll my eyes. Roll my eyes.
Yeah. Okay.
If you're looking at a copy, then I can have a go reciting it from what I remember, and then you can tell me if I got it wrong.
Okay. Sure.
Tell me about a complicated man. Muse, tell me how he wandered and was lost when he had wrecked the holy town of Troy. And where he went and who he met, the pain he suffered in the storms at sea, and how he worked to save his life and bring his men back home. He failed, and for their own mistakes they died. They ate the sun god's cattle, and the god kept them from home. Now, goddess, child of Zeus, tell the old story for our modern times. Find the beginning.
Ah, you got it.
Okay, good.
Yeah, that was fantastic. Wow, I'm impressed.
Okay, thank you.
We don't need the internet.
I wish I would have done the whole thing in Greek of that. And actually, I almost have, but I know I would mess up a couple of times and it would drive me crazy remembering that I'd done that.
So a lot has been made of the fact that you are the first woman to translate the Odyssey, one of the foundational texts in Western literature. Many people say this is a major milestone. Do you see it that way?
It's hard for me to figure out exactly how I think the narrative should be put. I think in some ways it should be a story that's less about me than about why has it taken the English-speaking world so long before there's been a complete published translation of the Odyssey by a woman. Translations not just of the Odyssey but of Greek and Roman texts in general over the last few decades in particular have tended to be done by men and men of a particular demographic, the elderly white retired professor man.
So do you think you brought a different sensibility to your translation because you're a woman?
You know, I think that the statistical sample set of how many women have translated the Odyssey into English is so small that it's quite hard to make generalizations about gender in this context, you know? There's only me and Caroline Alexander, and we're entirely different from each other stylistically.
Let's talk about some of the gender dynamics in the story. Let's talk about some of the women in the Odyssey. One of the most fascinating characters of all, Odysseus's long-suffering wife, Penelope, waits 20 years for Odysseus to return while she is fending off a lot of abusive suitors who want to marry her. And, of course, he has been unfaithful in his marriage. She has not. What should we make of Penelope's story?
So I think the poem is constantly giving us this contrast between Odysseus's insistence that he can make 20 years go away and Penelope's insistence that time has mocked her and that she's different and that her marriage is defined by abandonment. Adultery has different implications because, of course, the household depends on the woman staying with a particular man, whereas he can have affairs outside of the house and it doesn't affect the house.
And then there is her rather complicated relationship with her own son, who is a teenager during virtually all these years that Odysseus is away, and he seems to want to put her in her place at times. At one point, even says, shut up to his mother.
He says, shut up twice when she's trying to get the singer to stop telling the unhappy stories about Troy because it makes her too sad. Telemachus tells her to shut up and go to her room. And then later, she tries to give orders about the contest with the bow that she's setting up to choose a new husband. Again, he says it's his job to do that, not her. Mary Beard has written about the first scene as the first instance in Western literature of a man telling a woman to shut up. I guess I also think it's important to notice that Penelope also herself shuts up her slave woman, Melantho, such that the suppression of women's voices also comes from other women.
Let me ask you about the slave women in the household as well, because there's a horrible scene near the end of the book, which I had never really been aware of until it was pointed out to me as I was reading about your translation. When Odysseus comes home, he tells Telemachus to kill all these other women in the palace. Tell us about that.
So Odysseus comes home and he slaughters, after a lot of planning, and again, we should always apologize for the spoiler alerts. After a lot of planning, he does succeed in killing all the suitors who, as you say, have been harassing his wife for years and years that he's been away. He kills them all. They're all piled up in the hall. And then there's a cleanup problem, which is who's going to scrub up all the blood off his lovely furniture. And of course, the slaves are there to help do that. So he instructs the slave women to do all the cleaning up. And then he has to clean up the slaves themselves. So he tells Telemachus and the henchmen to take long swords and slash all the life out of these women, the women who've been sleeping with the suitors. And Telemachus then takes initiative and instead of hacking out their lives with swords, chooses to hang them with a single rope. And there's a powerful simile which compares them to birds that are trying to get home to go to bed in their roost. And instead they get caught in the net. So they're hanging there on the rope and their feet fluttered for a little while, but not for long.
That's just a horrifying image there. Now, there's also a question about translation here, because in some of the previous translations of the Odyssey, these slave women have been called either sluts or whores, and you do not use those words.
Yes. In several modern translations, Telemachus is made to say, I won't allow a clean death for these sluts, the suitors' whores. That's the Robert Fagles one. He says, you sluts, the suitors' whores. And there isn't a term of abuse in the original. they're described as the women who slept with the suitors. Of course, that's a particular cultural assumption, right? That in order to express anger at a woman, you have to call her a slut, even if the original language doesn't frame things in those terms.
I want to put your project of translating the Odyssey into a larger context here. There are certain issues that come up, especially violence against women, that maybe were kind of glossed over in the past. I know that in Ovid's Metamorphoses, there are a lot of rapes in those
stories.
There
are a lot of rapes, yes. And I think that is a change. I think it's extremely good for a lot of my colleagues who are aware that we can't have the same conversations about Ovid or about rapes in other works of classical literature, the rape of Cassandra in the classroom, that would involve not talking about it as violence. It's now forced on us by the 18-year-olds that we have to discuss it in an honest way that grapples with how ethically difficult it is.
The classics, it seems to me, have turned into a kind of battleground in the culture wars.
You're absolutely right. There are people who claim the Western canon belongs to white people or belongs to conservative people. There are fantasy readings of Homer and of other Greek and Roman classics, which involve an idealizing of, back in ancient times, rape was fine, masculinity was all about being very macho, and everybody thought that was perfect back then, which of course relies on a very simplistic reading of the text, erasing quite a lot of what's actually there. It's all in the service of a particular political agenda. And then, of course, when people question that agenda, then those people are said to be social justice warriors who have a political agenda rather than saying what the truth is.
You're saying there is politics to the art of translation.
There's always politics, yes. And I also think it's funny how male translators are assumed not to have a politics. But of course, this is a political poem, regardless of who's translating it and regardless of whether they're male, female, or something else.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's Emily Wilson talking with Steve Paulson about her new translation of The Odyssey. So if you love ancient myths, too, when did you fall in love with them?
I used to go to the Louvre Museum. As you walk in, at the top of this magnificent staircase is the Victory of Samothrace. And she's about 18 feet high. I was just riveted. The feathers, they extend out and beyond her, which gives it movement, and there's movement in her garment as well. She's actually landing on a battleship. She is coming to bring victory. She was so powerful and without apology. Day after day, I just kept going back and staring at it for hours. In some ways, which I didn't understand, I really felt my contemplation of that statue was feeding me. I'm in Paris. I'm a young girl. What am I doing?
Serenity Young brings us the unforgettable winged goddesses of the past and their hidden meanings after this. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. Thank you.
There are images of powerful women everywhere, hidden in plain sight. Maybe we don't quite register them as women because they have wings. Religion scholar Serenity Young noticed the famous Greek winged goddess of victory in the Louvre Museum, and she couldn't stop thinking about it. She wound up spending more than 20 years investigating winged women, and she found them everywhere, on every continent, as far back as myths and legends go.
The most ancient things that I've found are bird goddesses. They have perhaps a bird's head, a woman's breast and body, and a little bit of wings. I mean, they go back to like the 18th dynasty in Egypt. They're all throughout the world.
That's just fascinating. I mean, what do you make of that?
Well, I'm a religion scholar, and the human condition was so unpredictable. And when you looked up at the sky, it seemed so predictable. You know, they read the stars very early. And then birds fly between the heavens, but they land on Earth. And then they fly from Earth up to the heavens again. So they seemed natural carriers of messages between these realms.
You said once you started looking around for images and legends, myths of women with wings, you found them all over the world.
Yes.
Give us a sense of the range. What are some of the kinds of flying women that exist?
Well, of course, the Valkyries.
From Norse mythology.
Oh, yeah. They're great. They're not winged, but they fly over the battlefield. And when a hero falls, they scoop him up and carry him to Valhalla. And flying women are connected with immortality, with sex. So think about the idea of the succubi.
The what?
The succubi.
Sounds bad.
Oh, it's good. It's great. And this is a woman who comes to a man while he's sleeping and, you know, has sex with him, which, of course, explains nightly emissions. But the man can say, I was unwilling, you know, it was this succubi who came. I mean, it's just like, oh, please.
You make the point that in almost all cases, these women who fly, you can see them really as stories about women and power and men's efforts to control and constrain, capture, I guess.
Yes,
capture. The flying women.
No.
Is this because flying, it's about freedom?
Oh, yes.
You get to leave the earth.
Yeah.
What could be more powerful?
That's right. They want this aerial woman, but they want her not to fly and to be a domestic drudge. I mean, these are stories about women who have been captured and forced into marriages and having children and cleaning the house.
Wait, what stories?
The swan maidens.
Who are they?
Swans that transform into women. They're very beautiful.
So there's stories where magical winged swan woman flies down and the man says, you're beautiful, come live with me and have my children and cook my food.
No, they take their swan suit because the woman has taken off her suit to go swim in a pond. This is the molting thing, the losing of feathers. And then they're vulnerable to captivity and they cannot escape until they find where their swan suit has been hidden.
But this is a story about men stealing women's power.
Yeah, and literally stealing women.
Wow. You make this really interesting point in the book that I wanted to ask you about, which is that we're all pretty familiar with classic male heroic epics.
Mm-hmm.
Gilgamesh, Odysseus, King Arthur. But you suggest that maybe these flying women represent a heroic female model that's somehow different from the heroic male model.
Absolutely. The male hero goes forth. He leaves home and he has adventure and he gets involved with a woman, often could be an aerial woman or a woman with knowledge, and often a woman who knows the way to the land of the dead. And then they come home.
The men do.
That's right. The flying women, they leave home and keep going.
So the male hero always comes home, back to essentially the traditional order and structure of things.
Yeah.
And the female hero leaves?
Yeah, goes and does her own thing.
It seems to me that a lot of the stories about the most famous flying women I can think of, the women are often monstrous in some ways.
Oh, yes, I love them. I love them. These are all old goddesses. These are the old bird goddesses, which have to be gotten rid of because they're terrifying. My favorite are the Furies.
From Greek mythology?
Yeah. They famously pursue Orestes, who has killed his mother, and they exact revenge.
So you see some of these scary winged females as kind of harking back to this non-patriarchal time, like maybe they're holding sort of embodiments of non-patriarchal forms of knowledge?
Oh, I think so, because they're female and they're always killed by male heroes. But if I can just go a little further, I eventually decided I had to look at Christian mystics, females who were levitating all over the place. My particular favorite being Saint Christina the Astonishing. They used to chain her up because she was always living in trees or climbing up to rooftops. She found it, being on the earth, very, very uncomfortable. Now, you know, who's heard of her? Really, you just have to dig around and you find them in ways that are amazing.
That's Serenity Young. She's a religion scholar at Queens College in New York and the author of Women Who Fly, Goddesses, Witches, Mystics, and Other Airborne Females. And now I'm afraid it's time for us to fly away. But there is always more in our podcast feed. So browse the listings there and find something else to listen to. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by a pantheon of producers. The divine Halima Shah, Staff Socrates Shannon Henry Kleiber, the trickster Charles Monroe Kane. Mark Rickers drives our digital chariot. The god of our soundboard is Joe Hartke, ruled over by the executive producer Steve Paulson, and ruling supreme over all of them, me, Anne Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.